The prophetic dreams of individual bodies. Now, I do not wish to repeat the same type of analysis that Foucault used when he showed in the history of sexuality that the hypothesis of sexual oppression in the West could not be situated as sexual oppression, but rather as a continuum in the production of power relation. Very few people could not agree with him. In fact, the production of power relationships, even where sexual liberation is concerned, has been prevalent in societies all over the world, and I'm rather more surprised at Foucault's surprise than I am about his overthrowing of the oppression hypothesis. If sexuality is the contemporary theme of oppression, it is so foremost because it contains physical aspects by which individual bodies are categorized. The liberation of sexuality is as much part of these categories as its oppression is. This is one of the reasons why Roland Barthes refused to be labeled according to his sexual feelings, even if some have viewed Barthes' refusal as a form of political betrayal. But what Foucault failed to see is that in order for any system of oppression to be effective, even in its production of power relationship, there has to be ways which the actions of the individual bodies can be controlled beyond the immediate bodily presence. Even in the design of the panoptic buildings of prisons or the discourse of the psychiatric hospitals, individuals will always have our femininity principle to apply. My main objection against Foucault is that by focusing on the history of sexuality, he has failed to observe that power production can never do without status hierarchy. And questioning the oppression hypothesis easily leads to the conclusion that the notion of individual body perception, too, is a matter of producing power relations. So why bother with the idea that individuals could be oppressed? The possible installment of any status hierarchy, for me at least, starts with your objection to reality, which is... And indeed, the main objection to reality is its propensity to submit unconditionally to every hypothesis you can make about it. With this most abject conformism, it discourages the liveliest minds. You can subject it and its principle. What do they get up together, by the way, apart from dully copulating or begetting reams of obviousness? To the most cruel torments, the most obscene provocations, the most paradoxical insinuations, it submits to everything with an unrelenting servility. Reality is a bitch, and that it's hardly surprising, since it is the product of stupidity's fornication with the spirit of calculation, the drags of the sacred illusion offered up by the jackals of science. This indeed makes reality very objectionable. And this is true, but only true under the condition that reality does not exist. But here's something quite tricky at hand. As far as I can tell, in your work and that of many of contemporary scientists, reality in the social scene has become interchangeable with non-existing possibilities in representing the other. There's a strange twist of fate that seems to whisper, I cannot be your body, you cannot be my body, and therefore reality is non-existent. Whenever nowadays we speak of reality, we speak of something which is either represented falsely, represented well, reflected or non-reflected, and far most illusionary, even if it does concern a physical universe. Nobody seems to bother to speak of the reality of plain being anymore. Somehow, with Foucault and others, the notion exists that power relationships do not exist as objective or real categories, neither does status, authority, and hierarchy. We do not actually believe that the Victorian fear of sexuality is justified, but the true illusion of the real is that this reality does not seem to matter. My objection against Foucault is that his view of the production of power relationship is so flawless and perfect in their successive states of liberation and oppression that, whether real or not, it always works in silencing individual voices. In its pure constructivistic way, it is as flawless as God, the God of Hustler, Derrida's consensus, Popper and Merleau-Ponty's rationality, or Jung's collective unconscious. Here, I have to commit myself in leaving all that behind, including essentialism, as after writing numerous pieces about this phenomena, I have to conclude that there still is a reality principle, which is not empty, not nothing, not something one can make any hypothesis of. In opposition to this reality, there is the illusion of a status hierarchy, which is transformed, constructed, and applied through a linguistic principle, the only communicative principle able to outcast the reality of individual body perception. I have to stress here that it is a linguistic principle, not all of language. What it boils down to is a principle which manipulates proximity and distance, which disappropriates the human capacity for abstraction from the active participation by individual bodies. The Treatise of Prophetic Dreams by Artemidorus provided me at least with the example I needed to explain this, and this will take some length as Foucault's analysis on the surface seems much more convincing than mine. Now, Foucault focuses in his analysis of Artemidorus on the four chapters which deal with sexual dreams, but he does not mention that Artemidorus wrote five books on the subject of dreams, which contained all in all 358 chapters. Sexuality is not a very dominating part of Artemidorus' work. For some part, I agree with Foucault in the way that he applied the work of Artemidorus as a point of reverence on the general thoughts about sexuality in his time. Foucault needed this point of reverence to show that the mainstream of philosopher in ancient Greece did not constitute the whole of opinions on sexuality. Foucault is also right in retracing the will to know in its course of history, but he focused too completely on the idea of individualization, privatizing of physical taboos, and he summarizes these taboos as a mistrust of the pleasures, an emphasis on the consequences of their abuse for the body and the soul, a valorizing of marriage and marital obligation, a disaffection with regard to the spiritual meanings imputed to the love of boys, a whole attitude of severity was manifested in the thinking of the philosophers and the physician in the course of the first two centuries. I shifted my focus on the aspects of Artemidorus' interpretation of dreams in terms of their prophetic implication. I focused not so much on the problematization of the body, but instead of the problematization of language, and with it, the problematization of reality. In doing so, I found that the timely aspect of prophecy is the differentiation between proximity, presence, the here and now, and distance, to a certain extent, absence, the future. Furthermore, proximity is related to action, while distance is related to passivity, for I can only act for myself and reflect on the other. In Artemidorus' interpretation, we can find the key to the process of disappropriating language from individual perception. Artemidorus himself proclaims that dream interpretation is nothing more than a juxtaposition of similarities. Ironically, through involving the status of the dreaming individual by creating that ancient differentiation between ordinary and virtuous individuals, the juxtaposition of similarity becomes a hierarchy of knowledge in terms of the complexity of the linguistic nature of the dream. The first step in the process of key figuring the individual body is the subordination of the metonymic capacity of body perception. In interpreting the dream as prophecy, according to Foucault, Artemidorus makes a distinction in the way various dreams are linked with various kinds of dreamers. One type of dream, the type which concerns states of the body, like overeating, for instance, only seem to appear in ordinary people. First, these dreams reveal themselves as one possibility through a direct metonymic relation between the dream and the person. One is hungry and dreams that one is hungry. Secondly, these dreams can reveal themselves through signs referring to the state of the body by a symbolic allegory. In virtuous people, states of the body dreams never appear. They instead have event dreams, which always refer to something happening in the future. Ordinary people have such dreams as well, but they present themselves through allegories, enabling the dreamer to prepare for the event. In describing Artemidorus, Foucault creates a clear oppositional distinction between states of the body, enipneon, dreams, and event, onirous dreams. Term by term, then, enipneon and onirous are opposed to each other. The first speaks of the individual, the second of events in the world. One originates in states of the body and the mind, the other anticipates the unwinding of a temporal chain. One manifests action of too little and too much in the domain of appetites and aversions. The other alerts the soul and at the same time shapes it. On the one hand, the dreams of the desire tell the soul's reality in its present state. On the other hand, the dreams of being tell the future of the event in the order of the world. Now, dreams of the individual body and dreams of events in the world is not exactly what Artemidorus stresses, though one could easily shift the accents of the text towards an opposition like that. But as a matter of fact, Artemidorus views the individual, both body and mind, as crucial and central in his entire interpretation. In every dream, also in event dreams, the crux of the matter is not whether the individual body is taken into account, but whether these individuals are ordinary or not. If an individual can be labeled as not being ordinary, he or she will not have dreams of a metonymic character. Every interpretation in such a case needs to take into account that one deals with an event dream of a complicated nature. The process of separating the individual body from the abstract capacity of gaining knowledge about the future becomes very clear here. An ordinary person has metonymic dreams. His or her dreams are characterized by body and soul, signifier and signified, simultaneously coincide. Not pleasure or desire makes this ordinary suspect, but the total lack of any linguistic complication of the dream, in which things mean what they seem. The second step in the process shows that one does not need mysterious gods to create a hierarchy of knowledge. The status of the dreaming individual is enough. In fact, gods only stand in the way of accomplishing the status of the dreamer as high or low. For example, if a dreamer is knowledgeable on the topic of dream interpretation, the dream will be more complicated than if such knowledge is absent. This, too, is connected to the status of the dreamer, for a statesman is capable of knowledge concerning others. On the surface, this seems to be a contradiction, as on the one hand, as Artemidorus says, all dreams concerning the self which do not involve others, which arise in and for the dreamer alone, and which do not operate with regard to and by means of others, have a result for the dreamer alone. But where, on the other hand, the order of the world is concerned, Artemidorus never excludes the status of the individual dreamer, not even in cosmic dreams. He stresses that the status of the dreamer and the interpretation of the dream coincide in cosmic or public dreams, according to Artemidorus, that is. A statesman or a leader will have dreams regarding the future of his public activities. And though ordinary people usually do not have dreams which should be interpreted cosmically, they should be interpreted as such when more ordinary people dream such dreams simultaneously. Artemidorus maintains individual bodies as being determining for the meaning of a certain dream, but it takes only one statesman to have a dream concerning the order of the world, versus at least a group of ordinary people to obtain a similar result. Dreams which concern the order of the world, in Artemidorus' interpretation, are continuously in question. And Robert G. White, who translated the books of Artemidorus, observed that he, Artemidorus, cautiously avoids the question of whether dreams are sent by gods or whether they are motivated by something that is within the dreamer. In this, Artemidorus stands opposed to Aristotle. The beginning of the process of the hierarchy of accessible and inaccessible knowledge does not start with the chosen character of the dreamer, but with his position in society, his knowledge about the world, and his knowledge about his own body as being virtuous. Here I agree with Foucault that virtuous forms a category of relative control over body pleasures. But in Artemidorus' interpretation, virtuous is an exceptionally lucid idea, as he says. In the dream, being insane is auspicious for those who are undertaking business venture. It would be especially propitious for potential demagogues, for those who rule masses, and for those who ingrate themselves with the crowd, for they will be considered worthy of greater acceptance. And so too for being drunk. In a dream, being drunk is auspicious for neither man nor woman, for it signifies great thoughtlessness as well as complications in business. For drunkenness causes these things, but being drunk is good for those who are afraid of something, for men who are drunk or without cares and fear, nothing. Here it becomes clear what Artemidorus means by juxtaposition of similarities. The status of the dreamer coincides with the signification of the dream, and that status is conclusive. So too, for instance, with children. Children, according to Artemidorus, do not rule themselves, even if they are free-born. The process of the separation of body parts, as well as the symbolic capacity attached to this separation, also show a hierarchy of status, but not one that signifies the status of sexuality, or even certain types of sexuality. Here, I think Foucault focused too much on what he wanted to find, for he concludes, "And precisely, insofar it does not formulate an ethic, but uses for dream interpretation a way of perceiving and judging sexual pleasure that is contemporaneous with it, Artemidorus' book testifies to the endurance and solidity of that form of experience. But the only true pleasurable experience in Artemidorus' work is prosperity, many times connected with multiplication of goods. The lack of ethics in Artemidorus' work does not testify to the endurance of an ethical judging of sexual pleasures. Rather, it testifies of a continuous use of the body in justifying status, gain, power, and riches, for the result of sex acts are validated through the status of the dreamer. Artemidorus' interpretations tell not what is good for you or what is good for the individual, they tell what is fertile for your status within society, and the mere fact that the head, on top of the body, is an ancient symbol for capital, as this is what the word etymological signifies in both Latin and Greek, reveals that the process of metaphorizing of the body constructs the power of knowledge. Within the linguistic principle, it places the symbol, as well as its relative inaccessibility, at the top of the hierarchy. While the metonymic lack of complication in the dreams of ordinary people are at the bottom. The individual body, just like animals, merely serves as carriers to complicate language in order to maintain a hierarchy of status, and so does the construction of the other maintain the distance of that other. This linguistic principle of distancing our presence is what hierarchizes the difference between metonym, symbol, and metaphor, self, and other. In The Transparency of Evil, you write, "If the world has a history, we can hope to get a final explanation out of it. If, on the other hand, it was born at the stroke, it is susceptible of having an end set to it. We are protected from its end by this non-meaning which takes on the force of poetic illusion, illusion being preeminently the art of appearing, of emerging from nothing, protects us from being, and being also preeminently the art of disappearing, it protects us from death." Indeed, the ultimate intimidation of the individual bodies, their private experience, their private perception and expression, can only be distorted by creating the illusion of fearing death. And this illusion is most powerful in the denial of social attraction, for the fear is not in death. One private experience, as the case of Conan Doyle's Professor Challenger shows us, can turn such fear around. Rather, such fears results from those linguistic means which keeps us apart, which makes us isolated sensorium, as we cannot accept indifference, but neither indifference. It is within the art of seduction that the drama creates distances which become increasingly more complicated, as simplicity, or should I say complicity, of the metonym becomes too obvious for the crime scene to leave anything to be unraveled. Maybe the only true pathological problem within our culture is not the illusion of our senses, but the status we attach to language. If we keep this in the back of our minds, history lays still before us, according to Artemidorus. The entire back part of the head signifies the future, and madness in dreams foretells health for a sick man, for madness induces man to move and walk about and not lie prostrate in bed, not to be at rest, as they do when they are sick. But then again, I might be wrong, as I am really rather a simple-minded individual, and denying status by uttering difference seems to be the biggest crime of all. Don't you agree?